warm welcome to the new episode of Urbanista Magazine's Misadventures in Music podcast. And before we meet this month's guest, thanks to everyone who got in touch to say how much they enjoyed the Paul Simpson episode last time round, talking about his life and career with the Wild Swans and, of course, his book, Revolutionary Spirit, A Post-Punk Exorcism. Well, our guest today has more than a few stories to tell of his own. In a musical career which began in the early 80s with the Pale Fountains and took in, along the way, Shaq, Michael Head introducing the Strands, and in recent years, Michael Head and the Red Elastic Band. He's about to release his new album in May called Loophole, and there's a book in the pipeline too, as he enters his fifth decade making music and telling stories. I'm Mick Ord.
I'm Ian Prowse.
And welcome to Misadventures in Music, Mick Head.
Hiya,
yeah. Welcome. Good to see you.
Yeah, and you. Now, your last album, Dear Scott, was a commercial and critical success, wasn't it? Best album of the year in 2022 in Mojo. Number 3 out of 75 albums in the equivalent year charts in Uncut. So, no pressure this time round, eh?
No, that was, you know, did really well, you know. And we were completely made up of how well it did, you know, just showed how everyone's input, you know, we found a beautiful formula there. So, yeah. And so the pressure, no, because the songs for the new album kind of, I find, you know, some people say, you know, Mick, you know, the gap, God, it's fantastic. There's a short gap. And I think the mindset of the last album just flowed into the next one, songwriting wise. So there was, I didn't look at any pressure. Do you know what I mean?
No.
It was a natural flow.
I'd like to begin by saying I've been listening to your music for most of my life.
Yeah.
And thank you.
It's right.
Thank you. Well, nice one, lad. Right. No. Oh. Thank you for it.
Oh,
you
know, man.
Because it's, you know, so many great songs. What a journey as well.
Yeah.
You know, and I have a lot of kind of empathy for it because when you start, I've had a similar journey in that when I had Pele on a big label, and then, you know, and you had Pale Fountains, then you went to Shaq, and I had Amsterdam, and now basically I do it under my own name, like you. So, because you're the next generation ahead, I'm going, if Mick can take this journey, I can do it.
You know what I mean?
And I know Paul Weller kind of had a similar thing, didn't he? Jam Style Council, and then just completely found his feet.
Yeah.
And what I love about it now is you just seem to be in a really good place. Because it hasn't always been easy, has it? So
no, you're right. I'm in a good place.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, having a beautiful group of people around an environment.
Yeah.
That like you gravitate to, and they maybe gravitate to you.
Yeah. And you got married.
I got married, which is, you know, just beautiful.
Yeah.
Which
we were just talking about the you got married at St. George's Hall, and. The standing on the big sort of Greek architecture, you know, and looking into the city.
Yeah,
And you're happily married. It's a moment, isn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. Beautiful, you know, it's like, for want of a better word, you know, magical.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, as you say, Jono captures it, but, you know.
We have me and Mick have a mutual friend in the great photographer, John Johnson, who does a lot of our sleeves, and, you know, he's done yours as well, and we're very lucky to have somebody like Jono around.
We are, you know.
Captures what we do, isn't it?
We are, all right, lad.
Yeah. And he's a beautiful guy, and he just buggers off to New York without telling any of us as well, which is,
and
that's a bit of mystery to him.
Just sending the photographs willy nilly,
yeah,
like classics.
So, do you think this, for want of a better word, happiness? Has fed into you feeling more comfortable to just carry on writing, not worry about any pressure about, you know, any of that. When we were young, I don't know about you, when Pale Fountains on Virgin, were you?
Yeah.
And we were on Polydor, and it was just the pressure of it all.
Yeah.
And if that single didn't go into the top 20 after all of that build-up, you could just see that it was... You know, they were kind of losing interest in you, but
they did though, didn't they?
Yeah, they just go like, okay, maybe you're not what we thought. And so one day you're they're kissing your arse and they love you. You can have anything you want. And the next day it gets a lot more circumspect because it hasn't quite broken through. And that pressure is not something you have to deal with anymore.
No.
You just do it on your own terms.
Exactly, yeah. You know, and as you said, you don't get that when we were starting off, you know, when you're just starting off. It's like they had a formula, didn't they?
Yeah.
First single, second single, you know, third single album.
Yeah.
So, like...
And your first single got into the top 50, didn't it? So were they kind of saying to you, right, we want more of that? Because I read an interview that you did a couple of months ago, and you said they wanted to turn us into Haircut 100.
Well, they were, you know, they must have thought you have similar togs. We didn't.
Oh, no.
I think, you know...
Similar social background.
Do you know what I mean? No. I think they thought, you know, acoustic guitars, I think they were thinking.
Oh, yeah.
No one else had acoustic guitars, I think. They turned up with acoustic guitars. They'd seen a formula that might have worked for us, but they, you know, I always go back to, like, when they were listening to the demos of the first album, and, like, the managing director, they were fantastic.
Yeah.
But it was us going AWOL with orchestration and doing what we thought the song should be, not really thinking about is BLT or Noel Edmonds going to play it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just doing what we thought they wanted us for.
Yeah.
You know, you signed us with all these great ideas of orchestration and songwriting.
Yeah.
And here it is. And then it's, so, you know, it's, I just remember the managing director having his head in his hands going, you know, we need a single. Do you know what I mean? So, but saying that, the one with the orchestration, they got the first single, which went into the charts, you know?
Yeah. So, well, I mean, as well, if Gene's Not Happening doesn't become an international worldwide hit, that's their fault.
Yeah, I'll go with that.
Do you know what I mean? Having been in this, obviously, situation myself, that's their fault for various reasons, whether it be luck or timing or they're not getting it correctly lined up, because that's what, you know, that's a hit in anybody's money. So for them to, like, kind of then look back on you and go, oh, maybe we don't believe in you so much, maybe we got it wrong, which is kind of what they do, don't they? And they put you on your toes with it.
Yeah, sometimes they don't want to admit maybe that they've, you know, I don't know. Yeah. We just, unfortunately for the Paleys, there with that single. The lad who signed us left.
Yeah.
You know, within a month. We were only signed to him.
Then you're kind of out on your own. Oh, yeah. And the new guy who comes along,
you don't
belong to him, so he doesn't want to know you.
What you're just saying, and he didn't really get it.
Yeah.
So the only reason we signed with this young lad was, you know, quite a few labels were after us, but he had the same togs on, he supported Spares, he came up to Liverpool from London.
Yeah.
All the others. And
you could communicate with him.
Yeah.
And then he's gone.
Well, yeah, after that. Well, we signed it. Yeah. After about a month, he got a better offer.
Right.
But, you know, as you're saying, the fella who come in didn't really get it. And he was your kind of like mainstream A&R.
Did he supervise the second album then? Or was the guy around, the guy who signed you around for both albums?
No. He got off.
Oh, right, okay.
So, remember Some Bazaar? Steve-O, Soft Cell.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Steve-O offered him an offer he couldn't refuse.
Yeah.
Yeah, he said, do you want to run Some Bazaar or do you want to... Rob's like that. Because, you know, Rob was junior at A&R, you know?
Yeah.
And when we went into Vernon Yard, is a little office in Vernon Yard. When you say wall-to-wall tapes, you'll know it. In the old school.
Yeah.
So he had all these bands coming in, do you know what I mean? So he was passionate, you know. Yeah. He found us, you know. He came to the gigs. He was, I don't know, he was a bit, he had an attitude as well.
Yeah.
And
you're comfortable being.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Yeah. The politics of it changed, don't they?
Yeah. It was like, we'd done demos for the album and... The fella who come in didn't really understand, like, as a songwriter, you know, saying, they're great. I love that big chorus off the third one.
Yeah.
So we'll put that on the first one. And it's like, don't be daft.
Yeah.
Did you kind of stand up for yourself in those early years?
Yeah.
You know, like you said, no, this is what I want, and you weren't, or were you cowed by their sort of bullying or whatever tactics they employed?
No, because I wouldn't change lyrics. So maybe, no. Or you know, do you want to go down there? And I'm going, but that's what the song's about, you know.
So, well, from day one, you're an artist.
Do you know what I mean?
You're not there to, like, a piece of Lego to be taken apart, yeah, and put, you know, put this bit of song onto that bit.
Yeah, no.
You know.
So no, not really, you know. They were sound. We're, to tell you the truth, though, we were young, so we were, it was all fun, wasn't it?
Right, okay.
Yeah. You know, yeah. It was like, yeah. Me and Biffa thought this is just the way it went.
Yeah.
You know, all this fun. And because I'd been a T-boy, and I thought, and then someone, I got really, something really, I wouldn't say something really strange happened to me when I was a T-boy. Like, you think when you leave school, adults shouldn't treat youngsters like that. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I thought, do you know what? I'm joining a fucking band. No one's going to tell me what to do ever again. You know, no one's going to treat me like that again. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So forming a band and then actually people liking it. I'm getting, sorry for swearing then, by the way.
Oh, no, you swear.
Getting people respecting it, getting, you know, wanting to say, we can create this environment for you. Yeah. And by the way, there's fun along the way.
Yeah. So if your guy's gone early, it's amazing you got through two albums then, isn't it, really?
Yeah, you know. It's true. After the first one, we consciously changed our sound because during the tour, tour the first album was difficult because of the orchestration. But we were good at, not shortcuts, but making the best out of a situation and, you know, getting a piano and, you know, making it work to a point. But then I consciously wrote the second album that we could do it as a four-piece live. Our John was hanging around. He was only just turned 16.
Yeah.
He was hanging around the hotel with us.
Yeah.
Andy was, you know, he was, you know, his input onto some of the, of the second album, he was getting, not disillusioned, but I think he wanted to go his own way, maybe.
Yeah.
The songs were going in I was writing melodies where I was normally writing them for the trumpet. I was writing them like there's a guitar.
Yeah.
It's part. There's room there for a solo or
a
riff, a jeans or something. So I was writing consciously to do it live as a four-piece. So
I think artistically, though, as an album, it's a complete success, you know.
The second one,
I absolutely love the second one.
Yeah, it's we were still learning, you know. And as a songwriter, just
you still also have today. That thing of when you'd come in and they pick up the option and you're gonna make a second record, you go, I've got a record deal still,
yeah,
you still, record, yeah, you know, there's a lot to be said for being just.
Yeah.
A young lad with a deal and a fistful of songs, you know, and an opportunity, isn't it?
Definitely, yeah. So, you know, we wanted to.
And what
take
an amazing
it.
Leap from being a T-boy to get a record deal. I mean, you know, that's. You must look back and think.
Would you go back to it, the T-boy?
Invaluable, though.
Yes.
You know all the routes through town. Yeah. All the shortcuts, all the jiggers, all tunnels, you know, like, you know, I wanted to get from Tyburn Street to Castle Street.
Yeah.
I'd do it in a trice, you know what I mean? I'd be too. Especially if you've got a big typewriter.
Yeah.
You know, in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s, when they were manual.
Yeah.
In fact, them golf balls, I don't know if you've ever seen that.
Yeah, yeah.
They're dead heavy.
I've used them, mate.
You know what I mean? So, like, I'd have to take the little jiggers.
Well, and you'd have to carry them.
Yeah.
That was your thing.
So,
who are you working for? Come on,
Brian Green Business Machine.
Pardon?
Brian Green Business Machine on Bixter Street, Taiwan Street.
Okay.
And they repaired. You know, in the olden days when it was, remember, you'd have a pool of ladies in a room.
Yeah.
And they'd be like giving the ad machine.
Yeah.
Like that. There'd be like 9, 10, 12 of them.
Yeah.
All like that. So, them ad machines, we'd fix them, we'd sell them as well.
Oh, okay.
So, and
do you know when you in my head now, I've got this thing. When you finally left, did you do it like Jimmy and Quadrophenia?
Well, the Islington
fucking Frankie machine. Yours.
Yeah, only got the bus up Islington. Yeah,
but you didn't do that, though.
You had to give it that.
The first track you've chosen, Mick, is by Bowie, Lady Grinning Soul from Aladdin Sane. Is this one of his most underrated tracks, you think? Because I had to look it up, and of course I knew it. I played it,
I think it's the first one on Aladdin Sane, I think, and my dad bought me Aladdin Sane when it came out, say, when I was 12 or something, 13, and my dad was a Ted, so all my mum and dad had in the house was country and western, or like a bit of 50s stuff, which was sound, on this Christmas, he come home with one of them little tape recorders, and Aladdin Sane was like, you know, what's that? And put it on, and that came on, and with this list here, I just thought, you know, I was saying to Mick before, you know, when you get asked the questions of like, yeah, and sometimes there's a constant, like why, for example, I've got mine's always a constant. But with these are like songs that like stop me in my tracks for a particular reason. Yeah. And that one, just when I heard it, I thought, that's different. And kind of like the lyrics are amazing. And I loved English in school, English lit and that. And I thought, he's onto something there.
Yeah.
That fella, that
Bowie.
I remember
having a conversation with Paul Rutherford. And Paul talked about Bowie in a way that was so eloquent and beautiful, but also so fundamental to him as a human being and him as a lover of music.
Wow.
Which, because it's slightly ahead of me generationally, you know, so Bowie wasn't like our thing, you know, we were the Clash and the Jam and all that sort of thing. But when he spoke about it, I understood that for how powerful Bowie has been. Is that how you felt when you...
No, I
did
don't.
He become like...
He did, but it was a fluke by my dad, because he could have, I think his second one was T-Rex, which was still good, but yeah, in that one I thought he could have picked anything.
It could have been Chickadee Tip,
you know, honestly.
Where would you be now if it had been Chickadee Tip?
It could have been the Glitter Band, you know what I mean? And, and they were all out at the same time.
Yeah.
You're right.
I wonder why it was then that he...
It was one of them in a pub, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, I see.
Any of them tapes on his pot luck, I reckon.
America.
Beatle car. So I did, all right.
Yeah.
So were you from a musical background? You've mentioned your dad.
Yeah.
Listening to country music.
Yeah, but... No, not really. They both sang. But as most of our, you know, families did sometimes, you know, in the weekend, boozers and the family and that. So yeah. They both had good voices, but that's about it, really.
And was that the thing? Was them singing and playing the stuff at home influential to you? Or did you do that? Was that a separate journey from all that?
A separate one, really, because my dad, he had a guitar, but he kept it. You know, he wanted to put it away because it was, we had a wrecky, you know, so he kept it away from us. As kids, you're like that, all right, what are you doing? Yeah. You know, let's have a go. But then older, you think, well, fair enough, it's a classic. Yeah. You know, I'd have hit it. Yeah. You know what I mean? So I think our John started playing guitar, my brother. And, you know, I went, I'd left being a T-boy and then met Simo. You know, I was still a T-boy when I met Paul Simpson. I'd seen Teardrops the night before on So It Goes, I think. I used to watch So It Goes, and the magazine, the Team Music, used to get me every time. Bomb it in from whatever room I was in, Shot by Both Sides.
Yeah.
Like, oh, what's that?
Classic.
Yeah. And then found out what it was that. And then one night...
So the punk new wave thing did have a seismic effect upon you?
Completely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Watching, there was a Peter Cook programme called Revolver.
Yeah, I remember it.
And I think he had Penetration on, the Buzzcocks, loads of punk, and you're like, what's this?
Yeah.
You know, and then I didn't really watch the Whistle Test or nothing like that.
Well, it's your generation, isn't it? Live on the telly going, this is us.
Yeah. So it was refreshing, new, and because you're that age as well, you're thinking this is for us, yeah. So It Goes was on late, wasn't it? I remember.
With Tony Wilson.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was, wasn't it?
And so it was Northwest Arts, you know, so you'd have Dick Witts and Buzzcocks, probably early magazine doing, but then the Teardrops, they did Camera, and I just heard it and blew me away, you know, just heard the keyboard part, and my outfit was like that, what's up? And I was going, that's, yeah, I actually said to him, that's the future.
Right.
And the next day, because I used to have to deliver the typewriters around town, or the ad machines, or the early, before Sinclair computers, yeah. There was electrical department and a mechanical calculators and all. So I'd do all my deliveries in the morning. So by the time lunchtime, at my leisure, I'd go to Probe and all the second record shops and that, or whatever I need to do. That's where I met Simo. Just by fluke, kismet. You know, I'd seen you on the telly last night. That was incredible. Man.
So that was the kind of blowing your mind as a young kid.
That was like a pivotal moment for me personally. Yeah. You know, all excited. I'm inquisitive anyway, and I just thought like, and I think I had similar talks on.
Yeah. And, well, then you connected to Liverpool, don't you?
Yeah.
And you go,
because he's looking, he's like that.
It's not David Bowie, which is he a human? Is he a spaceman? And it's based somewhere else in London or New York. It's I've just met him in next to me.
And he looked as good as he did on the telly, do you know what I mean? He was like Simo, wasn't he?
Yeah.
When we were growing up, he just looked fantastic.
Yeah.
He did. He still does, you know?
Yeah.
And so I was, taken aback, but then got, you know, saying like, he said, like, do you play an instrument? And I said, no. And he said, you sing? And I just went, with Revolver, a couple of weeks earlier, I'd been thinking, well, yeah, I was singing them songs. I was going, yeah. I said, yeah. So that was it. And then he said, you know Yorkie? And I said,
that
no.
That the spark.
I didn't know Yorkie at all.
Yeah.
But he said, we rehearse in a house in Nugent Park, the Bunnymen and the Teardrops, in a lad called Yorkie's house, big house. We do the evenings and the Bunnies do the daytime.
Yeah.
But we don't do the weekends, and Yorkie's forming a band, and he's going to use all our equipment, and he's looking for something like, do you sing? And I went, yeah.
Right.
And that's what that then what you're just saying. That's when microseconds, isn't it?
Yeah,
you just go like that, can you?
And the rest of your life falls out of those seconds.
Completely, 100%.
Beyond cosmic, if you think about it.
Yeah, I agree, mate.
Do you know what I mean?
Complete really Christmas, really.
Yeah.
So, 1 minute on Kenny, doing that, T-Boy, and then next week, you know.
And then it envelops your whole mind and psyche, and you can't think of anything else, and you're obsessed with the whole, every detail of it.
Yeah, and you think, maybe this is what happens, you know, this is for
so when
new.
You,
didn't expect this.
Was there any musical instruments lying around the house? Did you have any... Was there any like family or uncles who played that you could go to learn chords, or was where did your family come from in terms of your granddad and everything?
Yeah,
was that Welsh, Irish, or anything like that?
Irish, round by Scotland Road.
Right. Okay.
So
there's always singing and music around anyway, isn't there? In that sense.
Yeah. No, there was no instruments, but John picked it up. Yeah. Someone asked me a couple of months ago, and because I answered, it refreshed my memory, and it was Dave Pitch from the record company, and he said, "So we played trumpets in the house," and I went, "No one." Yeah. He goes, "So how come it's all trumpets?" And I went, "I don't know, you know." And he went, "So we played cello," and I said, "No one." And he goes, "Right." And then I'm sitting there, and then I thought to myself, "Do you know what?" And you will know when remember the test card of music.
Yeah.
So, I reckon being a sponge with music, I heard a lot of Sergio Mendes and a lot of classical with the test card of music growing up at school, off school, summer holidays. Because you only had three channels, and half the time it was test card of music.
Yeah.
And they played a lot of good stuff. And I think in my subconscious, I was formulating it up.
Mm-hmm.
And when it came to like, constructing, structuring songs, I had like a subconscious confidence of going places.
Isn't that interesting, that? How something not as kind of overt as, say, watching Top of the Pops or So It Goes or the Old Grey Whistle Test, something like that, I think that's amazing. Yeah. That as a non-musician thinking, wow, so that would affect the way in which you thought about music. And
maybe seep into your psyche.
Yeah.
You know, you're not really knowing it's doing it.
You've had the trumpet as an emblem for a long time, haven't you?
Yeah.
Ours has always been a fiddle, but yours has always been the trumpet. And it's a really strong personality to have to weave your music around.
Yeah, oh God, yeah.
And
acoustic as well, you can go anywhere.
And you kind of don't really even know where it came from. It's just kind of it's subconscious, really.
Yeah, it was like when me and Biffa played our first gig with the Paleys and we seen Andy Diagram.
Right, yeah.
We were like that, you know, he needs to be in our band.
Oh, right, yeah.
And, you know,
And then you get to, you know, all these decades later, and it's just been with you the whole time.
Yeah.
Again, just strange circumstances, isn't it?
Yeah. It's beautiful, though, you know.
Yeah,
the way our minds work.
Yeah. It's not... how people think it is.
No.
It's a lot more
It's
different.
Magical, isn't it?
Yeah. There's something to it which you can't put your finger on, isn't it?
Well, no trumpets in the next.
Go ahead.
This is the Seven Seas of Rye by Queen. Queen and Seven Seas of Rye. And I remember this being on Top of the Pops at the time. And apparently, they were the last-minute replacement for David Bowie, whose video, or in those days, film of John I'm Only Dancing was supposed to be on.
Yeah.
But it didn't arrive on time.
Okay.
And they thought, who can we get on? And some genius, or maybe researcher or T-boy said, get Queen on. And they got them on. And they were a last-minute appearance.
Well, in the same token, the Sex Pistols were a last-minute replacement for Freddie Mercury on the famous show where they swore. On the Bill Grundy show. Freddie Mercury had the flu. So it was the guy monster, the Jewish guy who was the plugger.
Eric.
Yeah.
Yes, I know.
Well,
what you mean.
He was the plugger for EMI, and he goes, oh, I've only got one other band I can put on. And he sent the Sex Pistols down, which kicked off the whole thing.
Wow.
So there you go. That's mad as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
So Queen were the recipients.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Did Freddie Mercury have black nail polish on Top of the Pops?
I think
that's my 10-year-old memory.
Yeah, do you know what? I think that was the next single.
Oh, was it? Okay, yeah, yeah.
Because I remember that. Yeah. With the big fair coat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So go on, tell us about picking a Queen song. I'm all ears.
It was the same. I was thinking yesterday, I thought, you know, I was looking at them and I thought, yeah, dude, songs that, you know, have stopped you in your tracks, and they mightn't be like your favourites, or there's a couple of constants in there. But with Seven Seas of Rye, so I didn't know it was 74, I thought it was a bit later. It was one of them in the livvy again, in the living room. And just hearing it on the telly and thinking, what's that? Yeah. And never hearing it. And because, like, there was never anything like it at home.
Yeah.
You know, so, and yeah.
Because again, it's really dramatic, isn't it?
Yeah. You know? And my dad wouldn't have had it. And my mum wouldn't have had it. So, and I didn't have an older brother or an older sister or cousins or older mates on, you know, the way I take my hat up to, like, the lads in the band. They've got their mums and dads, for example, because they're half my age. But with all their musical albums, you know, so with Queen, I just stopped me in my tracks. I just thought, that's different. And also, again, I thought, what a beautifully crafted song.
Yeah.
You know?
They're very musical, weren't they?
Yeah.
You know?
I think in my youth, I was thinking, because of Bowie, maybe, and because I had Aladdin saying in my locker, and I was thinking, like, oh, you know, you know, you're listening to, like, music now, and you... But then I heard that, and it just... Whether it was... And there was something appealing about Freddie.
Yeah.
You know, even as a kid, as a teenager, he was, like, just a boss frontman.
Yeah.
You know, and different.
He wasn't a pretty boy, really, was he? Like some of the, like, say, Robert Plant or them.
He was pure theatre, wasn't he?
Yes,
it was theatre.
Yeah. And I know what you mean, about the pretty boy. He had a charismatic face...
Yeah.
The haircut.
And you wondered what they were going to do next after that.
Well, Freddie was going to enjoy himself, wasn't he?
Killer Queen. Yeah. What a second single. Yeah. And then Now I'm Here. And just went boom, 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 boom with singles.
Yeah.
It was fantastic.
Well, they did that thing as well, didn't they, Queen? Of they constantly changed, you know?
Yeah.
By the time you got to, like... Is it Hot Space and they're doing all this, or they're doing like dance music now?
Yeah.
And but if they line in behind Freddie Mercury, they're going to be able to pull it off because he's got such a huge, big theatrical personality.
Yeah,
that it's, you know.
Yeah, I think a lot of bands have to get to that point where they, you know, they have to diverse their ideas. So they should we do an album like that?
Yeah,
or like say Blondie when they went like Atomic and. Different avenues, you know, talking heads.
So you had your time with the Paleys, and then you formed Shaq, didn't you? And you got deals there, didn't you? You know, you got record deals there. And then just talk us through that period, because I remember seeing you, I can't remember where, in Liverpool, and thinking, this is going to be the, you know, this is going to be the next big thing.
Well, the thing is that once the Pale Fountains had ended, there was no question about it. You were gonna do, you're gonna carry on and do another thing, weren't you?
Yeah.
You didn't go, oh well, it didn't happen for me.
No, but
you're gonna write more songs.
Yeah, I was always writing. Yeah.
That's the thing. Isn't it?
Yeah,
you're compelled now.
Yeah, you mightn't have a name for the band, or you mightn't have like
this is your life till they put you in the box, isn't it?
You're fine. Yeah, exactly.
And
you know, yeah, that's from yeah. So that I was doing that, just carried on writing, and then it evolved, you know, Shaq.
Yeah.
Me and our John were always going
to
be together.
It's kind of hard to get another thing up and running after you're known for this one thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You find resistance from quarters, and you also, you're up against yourself and all in a way, aren't you?
Yeah, so I need
you
to.
You kind of have to go, I'm going to get even better. And well, for me, Shaq did as well.
Yeah, I know. And I was, you know, getting more proficient, not only playing, but songwriting.
You're almost, it's like a big game of musical snakes and ladders, and you've gone all the way, you've got to near the top, and you've come down the stake, and you're at the bottom again, and you've got this new band called Shaq.
Yeah.
How did all that feel?
Well, I was glad to come back from London when the Paleys disbanded. It was a bit soul-destroying, really, because they wanted to do another album, but wanted to use session musicians, which I thought was daft. So we all came back to Liverpool, gave the flat up, but it kind of put an atmosphere around the whole situation. As you're saying, I was still writing, there was songs still floating through. If somebody said, do you want to do an album, you've got five songs, I'd go on another Paley's album, but you're using session musicians. I said no, didn't fancy that. So
you're not George Michael, are you?
No, I didn't. We were a band, we were all in the same flat, you know what I mean? So we came back to Liverpool and we went our separate ways, really.
How old would he have been at this point?
Biff.
How old are you?
At this point, come back. So 24.
God, that's young, isn't it?
Yeah, 25.
Yeah.
Completely positive. It was like, and as you say, but saying that though, mate, I always say to people, you know, getting so close, but not that. And I always think we did things on our own terms.
Yeah.
And whatever that was, as close
as we're still there, the record.
Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I always think, what's there? And don't get me wrong. It's like, I understand that. And I get you to a point. I always think to myself, you've got to be, after that, I just thought, fine, you know, let's, like, not regroup, but I had to get a flat in Liverpool, so I got a flat, and then kind of, in a way, for want of a better phrase, started finding myself on my own terms.
Right, yeah.
Going from, like, say, for example, T-Boy to... Paley's got a shedload of money in a short amount of time, do you know what I mean? Yeah. And coming from, say, like, the background, I can't talk for Biff, but coming from, say, my background, it was like, okay, so, and it's gone with kind of a flow of, like, maybe this is the way it goes, you know. So it was kind of. So as I said before, going along with who lives in a hotel for a year, so you know, going on, and then so getting back to Liverpool was like sitting off and discovering a couple of things. I don't smoke tobacco, but I discovered other things. You know what I mean? To expand my mind and write songs on a different state of consciousness, for example. And that was liberating. So Shaq evolved from that in a way.
Yeah.
When my dad turned around and said, what are you doing writing these protest songs? Not to just comments. Who killed Clayton Square? Who did Recce?
Yeah.
They were just observations.
Well, you come from a fine tradition of you asking questions like that.
Yeah.
You know, going back hundreds of years, you know, Woody Guthrie and everything
exactly.
else.
Exactly. Well, yeah.
Yeah, and it's important. It's still important to this
exactly,
day.
Yeah. And your observations, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, you know, most of your songs from that period have got very definable stories, haven't they?
Yeah.
Streets of Kenny.
Yeah.
Obviously. And how did Noel Gallagher get involved? Because his record label had a couple of your albums, didn't
they? Yeah, they had one album.
One.
We bumped into each other for the first time in Glastonbury. It's one of them. I hadn't met him. He hadn't met me, but we were walking together. He had a big smile on his face. I had a big smile on my face. We hugged each other. And then we hung around with each other for a bit. And then, you know, he kind of took to me in the band and said, we'd love to do an album. He was like, yeah.
You know, which album was it that he did?
Miles and Gill.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
on the corner of Malden Gill, yeah. which was, you know, we were like, yeah. I mean, it was good because there was terms where I think we agreed to do it, but part of it was like, you use our studio with our chef. And we were like that, right, okay. And they're going like, but he's like, it's cordon bleu. And yeah. we're going, yeah, right. And he goes, and it's this amount of money. And we're like, oh, forget it.
Yeah.
We'll go to the Chippy.
We'll go to the village.
Yeah. And the Chippy. Yeah.
They'll have a lobster pot there.
So we did it in Pall Mall, in Lytton Town.
Right.
And, you know, then the Marybone Chippy.
Yeah.
So yeah, he was really good. He loved the music and his sound as well.
And did he have any active part in it, or did he just say, use the studios, it's up to you what you do? There was no interference like at Virgin.
No. No, because we always said in the meantime, you know, for example, we collaborate, you know, just as an aside. So that's how the conversation kind of. And then once. We never dealt with Noel after that, really.
Because that album came after HMS Fable, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Which was kind of the big record for you at the time,
yeah.
wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know, just 12 magnificent songs, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
From the very first chord.
Yeah.
It's kind of brought you right back into it.
Yeah.
And that was... So that must have felt lovely after all of the soul searching and disappointment of your previous band and everything
yeah.
to all of a sudden be flying high with that particular record.
Yeah. Therefore, it was what we were doing, you know. Yeah. Just, I was fine you doing something. As you said before, I write songs, I that's all. And
And you don't know what sort of songs you're going to write,
no.
do you? Like, they just come no. out. And...
So, and then, yeah. So I've never actually dwelt on anything or looked back. And I'm always, and as you said, always writing. So whatever the last album did or whatever the perception of the last album yeah. did, I wouldn't say it was irrelevant because you're so excited about moving on to the next thing.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, oh, okay, that's fair enough. And
well,
let's
you don't,
move
there's,
on.
There's no point in just reproducing what you've just done. If anybody wants that, well, go and listen to it, because that's that.
Yeah, yeah. I can't. No. I'm, before the last album's finished, I'm on to the next one.
Yeah, yeah.
Or at least integrating the songs into rehearsals, you know.
Yeah.
To, you know, it's...
That's what keeps you alive and vital as an artist, isn't it?
Yeah, and going forward in life, yeah. for me personally. Yeah. Focus.
Yeah. Because, I mean, you can play loads and loads of old songs in your set, you've written them all,
mm-hmm.
and you do,
yeah.
but there's always loads and loads
of
new
ones
as
yeah,
well.
Yeah,
and that's what, as the artist, that's the bit that you really enjoy, isn't it?
Yeah.
And when somebody gets onto your new one or says something about
yeah.
it, you're more thrilled with that than anything.
I love that, you know, when yeah. people say to me, you know, any songs, but so, yeah. you know, new ones as well, or if someone goes, someone will say, fucking tune or some
yeah.
tune.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And yeah. you're like,
well, the next one you've chosen, Mick, is. It's Wire, Outdoor Miner.
No blind spots in the leopard's eyes can only help to jeopardize the lives of lambs that shed the cries. An outdoor life for a silver fish, eternal dust, less ticklish than the clean room, a house guest. Side, is he trying to hide? In fact, it's the earth which is known since birth. He lies on his side, is he trying to hide?
was living and my mum was on the estate in Kenny. There used to be a lad on the estate who was so ahead of everything that was going on. He was from a big family. So he had older brothers and sisters, so his togs or his music. For some reason, he'd always liked playing me new stuff. He'd always say, come, you know, punk, you know, come round, or he'd play Stones or like, have a listen to this, have a listen. So I would and go round. And he played me Wire, and it's another one of them, just stopped me in my tracks again. Just a pop song, I think. But
because it's post-punk now, isn't it?
So
it's,
do you know what I mean? It was like, so if you were looking in the racking probe, it'd say punk.
Yeah.
And got it home, yeah. And it was like, oh, I heard it in chairs, and got it home, and you heard the B-side, and it's like, wow.
Remember I got the first Commissata Angels album?
Yeah.
Fucking fantastic, even to this day. You know, it's that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. They were similar.
Minimal, wasn't it?
Yeah. But well played. You could tell they were intricate, you know, proficient, well proficient in the playing and that.
And I don't know whether it's true of all the albums you've done, but going through some of the reviews of them, ecstatic is the word a lot of the time from the music critics. Over the years, I mean, you were on the front page of the NME, weren't you?
Yeah.
Was that around this time, Mick, or maybe a bit later? And did you take any of that on board, or did you just say that's bullshit, or did you think... You know, did it do you good to have that positive?
I think he was allowed to be excited by being on the front of the enemy.
It was
he must have got on the ale for that one. I would have.
So it was a really good interview. And then, when they said it's going on the front page, we were like, well, record label were delighted, obviously. That's do you know what I mean? And
it's nice, isn't it, to have a career of supporters, isn't it? You know, and to have. Well, you haven't sold millions and millions of records. It's just been a constant steady of deeply appreciated, you know, journalists down the years.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, it's like when, you know, it's their opinions, isn't it, journalists?
Yeah.
So a lot of the time we respect
their
opinions, so like, yeah. For me personally, a journalist's opinion, and you know, it's like you do respect that because you're thinking, this is your thing, you know, you've got this job in this magazine or on radio or TV, so you must be capable of doing a good review.
Yeah.
So you take that, and as you said, it's not a monetary thing ultimately like that. Yeah. People coming up in the street saying, you know. I love that as well, you know.
It's different though, isn't it? Because it's kind of more democratic in a way, in that you'll put a new song out and all of the people are the journalists, aren't they? And they tell you how they feel about it.
Yeah.
And in a way, it's kind of like, it's just as lovely as any
definitely.
NME front cover, isn't it?
It is. You know.
If you put something on online and you know, you get showed, look at what ordinary people are saying about this song of yours, and that's must be so satisfying. I know it is for us. So
saying thank you,
all
abbed up for the music. You know what I mean?
That's it.
Well, thank you. And do you know what I mean? That means so much to me.
Well, I suppose I do this thing. If I meet somebody whose music I've listened to for a long time, I'm over there thanking them because
they've done that
creativity.
Yeah.
You know, and
I know what you mean. It's respect, isn't it?
It is respect, yeah.
You know what I mean?
I know. From fellow musicians, because journalism, it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? It's great when they say nice things about you. And then when they slag you off, obviously they're wrong. whereas when a musician says it, that must be, you know... It's like when I worked in radio, and if someone worked on another radio station would say, oh, you're doing a good job, it means more, doesn't it? I would have thought it would anyway.
I know what you're saying. Yeah, you feel that respect, don't you?
Yeah.
The longevity thing as well now where you've come to, that's such an accomplishment, isn't it? You must feel that coming now to be here in, you know, in your 60s and going, fucking hell. I got here. Because I'm sure you've had times where you've thought, I ain't going to fucking get anywhere. I'm going to get out the end of the street. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know.
And in a nutshell, yeah,
yeah. And then you get here and you got like a great young band now.
Yeah.
And you go and play gigs. People love it. Yeah. Look, what an achievement.
Yeah. Oh, it's a nice one.
And you can go, you can look at your set list and you go, you know what? I could play those 18 songs. I could play a different 18 songs and they'd still be as equally strong as set list.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's the thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, nice one, love.
The next one you've chosen, which won't surprise anybody, is by Love.
Go ahead.
And it's Softly to Me.
Sit around all day just crying happy tears, to dance and sing my life away, laughing with you, my darling, softly to me. Orange sugar, chocolate, hot cinnamon, and lovely things in you. And darling, you know there was really nothing else that I could do but dance and sing my life away, laughing with you, my darling, softly to me. And my darling, you will never know how elegant you'll always be to me. And my darling, I was so in love, it's evident for anyone to see, and I suppose they probably already do. And how come so suddenly everything depends on you? To dance and sing my life away, and laughing with you, my darling, softly to me. And if I kissed you once, I'd probably do it again. But then that's not so inconceivable, my friend. To dance and sing my life away, and laughing with you, my darling, softly to me.
Sacrosanct in Liverpool to say what I'm going to say, but I've never heard that.
Yeah.
And I can hear you. I can hear your music in there.
Yeah.
Beautifully illustrated. So it means a lot to you then, obviously.
Yeah, it's the first song by Love that Yorkie was when he was in his brainwashing phase when I first met him. And when I started rehearsing in a Yorkie cellar, Julian Cope had been doing a similar thing to Yorkie, where he'd be playing him all kinds of records. Listen to this. So Yorkie's buying all these albums, you know, on Julian's recommendation. So then playing them to me. And he played quite a lot, but when he played that came on, I just thought, halt.
Right, okay.
What's that? Because he was playing quite obscure stuff. Beefheart, which is fine, and Henry Cowan, the Red Crayola, which I was thinking, Jesus, calm down. let me do something I can get my ears around first. And that just hit me. And then I said, what's that? And he said, it's Love. And he gave me the sleeve. And it's a sleeve to revisit it. And he looked the part. And this is about 1979 when he's passing me this, 79, yeah.
When did it come out?
I reckon about
Yeah, and I've got it here. 67.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So
it's only 11 years, but then that's decades when you're that age, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when you're a teenager.
Yeah.
So I thought, all right, I'll give it a go. Like, you know, and got her home, and me and our John used to share a room, and we'd have this game where we'd listen to things on the tape recorder. I think we had a record player. We'd give them points out of 10. What do you think of that? Let's see what you've given it, and they'd be like, oh, 8.5 or 9. Put love on, and she said, well, I know what I've put, and I know what you've put. And you've put 10. Boom, there's 10. Because it was just like, we'd never heard anything like it.
Yeah.
No.
You know, it was like...
No one was playing Love on the radio in 1978, 79.
No.
They were kind of... I'd heard of them and I heard of Arthur Lee, but that was it, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm the generation.
So lucky.
A bit older than you. So for you to discover that must have been like a jewel.
It was.
You know.
It really was.
This has been a constant in your life as well as an inspiration, has it?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Because like learning to play guitar, you get the Beatles songbook, you know, and it's like, I learned a couple of chords and I was taking shortcuts. I was thinking, get a few chords, write a song, you know, so I was doing it like that. So with the Beatles songbook, you're getting more adept. I was getting more adept at, you know, more chords.
Yeah. Learning the tricks.
Yeah, learning. Yeah. Oh, you know, not picking at the time, but just learning the chords. I was really proficient by now. With two hands, rhythm, and changing of the chords. So with the Beatles songbook, I was crafting songs. I was my own songs. Obviously, with that, you know, when you hear Love, I started getting a bit too big for my boots. I thought, yeah, they're intricate.
Yeah.
So, like, I'm not saying I was trying to... We did call our band, ultimately, the Love Fountains, but because we were inspired by them, influenced by them. Yeah. But I was crafting songs with more structure, more interesting, middle eights with purpose. You know, that can be like a string solo with a brass solo with a breakdown and something, you know.
Yeah.
And
to make it tell, make it
to make it a song, and yeah, make it memorable, maybe, and so and different. And so, like,
where are they a love from?
Most of them are from, I think, LA, but artists from Memphis, and they all gravitated to the Strip, early 60s, mid 60s. So by the time Love. But they were all knocking around Sunset Strip, got a band together. They just rented this big house in Hollywood, like I think it was Bela Lugosi's house or something. And
of course.
All moved in there. And being 1966, 67, 68, had a ball.
Yeah.
And wrote them so albums.
I assume they were called Love because it was the Hayes Asprey kind of the height of the hippie.
Maybe so, but maybe it preceded that.
Oh, did it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Maybe by a few years, maybe.
Oh, right.
When the scene kicked in, say, in San Francisco, maybe 60. Maybe
How many albums did they do?
Well, they did. I think they did about 5. The 3 where they made as the main band, if you like.
Yeah.
And then, say, 1970 kicked in and everything dispersed.
Yeah.
In loads of different ways.
Okay.
So then he got more experimental.
Yeah.
So more session musicians on the 4th and 5th albums, which is still great. More jazzy, more experimental.
Some great stuff still in there.
Yeah.
What was it like when you did the tour with them?
Oh, fun.
I mean, because you got... How did you meet Arthur in the first place?
Well, we were... I'd never produced anything in my life, and Stefan, a French promoter, had said come over to Liverpool, and he'd seen a French film we'd done a few years earlier, and he said, would you want to produce this band from France? And I said, yeah. And listen, I had an idea, I heard the song, but but I had an idea for a song for them as well. Went down to the session in Steve Powell, Clarence Street. Did it, it was fantastic. Stefan then said, why don't you fancy doing an album, which ultimately became the Strands album. But in the meantime, he said, oh, Delia's looking for a backing band. I was like, oh, come again. And he said, yeah, he's coming to Europe. He's got like an EP out and he's playing in Paris, London and Liverpool, and he wants a band and his manager wants some.
That's like, you know, some sort of
kismet
weird
again.
Dream come true. Yeah, completely. That he's playing Liverpool and you get kind
100%,
of.
100%, yeah.
That's fucking nuts, isn't it?
It is nuts, but you know, when you're going along with the flow, yeah, and thinking, all right, maybe this is the way it goes again. Wow. Thinking, okay, fair enough. So his manager, so I phoned, I had to phone his manager in LA. That red phone box at the end of Catherine Street.
Okay.
Yeah. And about 20 quid, isn't it, in quids. And phones him. And he literally did say, you know, what song, what love songs, you know. And I said all of them.
Yeah.
And he said, no, what songs, you know, really? And I said,
all of them.
And I basically said, and there's a really difficult one called The Castle. And I said, John can play. I said, John can play The Castle in his sleep. And he kind of went silent and went, all right. Because he knew it meant business then, because it's a really hard song to play. No one would say that if they couldn't do it.
Yeah. Tell us about when you got to rehearsals and he walked in for the first time.
Oh, man.
Was your bottle going a bit like...
Well, he's supposed to meet him in the afternoon in a cafe, but I'm in my room. It's about 8:30 in the morning, big boot on the door. I'm thinking it's chambermaid. Like that, I'm all right. So there's another big boot on the door, and I think, all right. So I open the door, and it's, Michael! Arthur, come in. So I'm in my bills. So got dressed, and he said, I'll wait downstairs in the cafe. Yeah. So he was early. It was 8:30 in the morning. So we weren't supposed to meet until like about...
What? Not how you expected to meet you.
No. Yeah. And then, you know, he's about 6'4". I was going to say 6'4". No, he's about 6'1", 6'2".
Yeah, he's
imposing,
a big man.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And all arted up. Stripey kecks, bins. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Different colour bins.
In your undies.
I'm in my bills.
So, not the way I planned it.
But, you know, psychedelic paisley ones. So, get knocks on the lads. He's downstairs. So we all get downstairs. And knowing us, and we're not the sort of people to have been... To make him uncomfortable by being in awe of him.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Okay. It was just natural.
Yeah.
It wasn't a conscious thing. It was early. Everyone was just like that. Can we have?
And once you've done the first bit, it's just music then, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, nobody's in the language of music. Nobody's better than anybody else anyway, is it? It's just
no. He was just listening.
Yeah.
Yeah. He just listened. You know, to us all giving it that, and then at the rehearsal, there's a song. Your Mind, it's quite appropriate, really. We said, do you want to do Your Mind or We Belong Together? And he said, you don't know that. And I said, we do. And he goes, Love didn't know that. I said, wow. Well, we do.
Yeah.
And he was like, all right. And we played it. And there's a solo at the end, and our kid nails it. And he just walks up to our kid at the end and goes, we'll finish with that. And we did know, you know, I think he loved the fact that, like, just for lads from Kenny, knew his first three albums Inside Out.
I wish you would have been a fly on the wall there, don't you? Oh, wow. What an experience for you.
I'm telling you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm such a beautiful, beautiful
man. And you did three shows?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then in the soundcheck in Liverpool, he went, Michael, it's good to be home. Because he'd played in the wrestling stadium in 1971.
Oh, in the stadium?
Really? And had a mooch around Liverpool. And I think, when people ask me sometimes in interviews, I think BFAR played in the late 60s or early 70s in the stadium as well.
Right.
When people ask me, why is BFAR big in Liverpool? There's a section in Liverpool with BFAR.
Yeah.
There's a section with Love. Yeah. And I think it's an overspill from that when they played in the old, and the old heads around the town were passing the album around, giving it that in the crowd.
Well, Beefheart had an exhibition, didn't he, at the Blue Coat?
Okay.
In 71, just of his art. And Brian Biggs, who's the boss of the Blue Coat, he's there now, and he was there in the early 70s, and Beefheart did his art there, So there was a link, like you say. There was a link between these people.
I reckon so, you know, I reckon that was it. Because he did play as well, like, seep through.
I bet you couldn't believe it, though, would you?
No. It'd be like you playing with Springsteen, wouldn't it, or something?
There you go.
Yeah. You know what I mean?
It's music. That once you started playing...
Well, of course.
You're just doing your best, and you got music.
I did the hotel jamming. Do you know what I mean? Don't sit on me hat.
Yeah.
Okay.
Was he all right, like?
And his boss.
Was he?
Proposed to me sister.
Did he?
Yeah. Will you marry me? She's going, no, I'm engaged.
You know, wow.
He was only on...
Absolutely. Next track is The Kinks and Autumn Almanac. From the deuce of hedge creeps a chronic
first heard that, the radio was always on in the house, so always got the hits, didn't get many album tracks, you know, I'd always heard the hits, or Waterloo Sunset, growing up with that, Lola, the others, You Really Got Me, but never really heard the albums, and then when I heard, you know, the Kinks album, I just thought, what a beautiful song, what a lovely, you really thought that through, the content, the lyrics, the structure, the breakdowns, you know, people say quintessentially English, and he's nailed it.
He
said, I'm going to write a quintessentially English song, there you go, boom. And I think that he's kind of, that's what he's done in a way, it's all his references.
Yeah.
It's a bit of an instruction manual for songwriters, yeah, isn't it? Do you know what I mean? You're going to go, right, I want to do me very, very best and try and get a feeling. And that's he
did it all the time, didn't he?
Yeah. He's got a lovely... he's a great songwriter, isn't he?
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. The atmosphere which he evokes is something else.
Yeah, his lyrics and, you know...
He's unique.
Yeah.
He's unique.
Yeah.
In many ways, isn't he? That both musically and choosing subjects about eating your roast dinner on a Sunday and I like doing this and that, you know.
A Cockney element to it.
Yeah.
You know, a working class Cockney element to it. And you know, his brother Dave was quite innovative, you know, with his with the guitar sounds for them early singles.
Yeah.
But you'd only learn about it as you're getting older.
Okay, yeah.
You know, personally.
Yeah. The vignettes that he would write about the world, it was, you could make a feature film off any.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, I loved all those old ones, Ape Man and all of those ones as they went on. Fabulous stuff.
Yeah. And it makes sense to almost segue into the Beatles track that you've chosen.
Your day breaks, your mind aches, you find that all her words of kindness linger on when she no longer needs you. She wakes up, she makes up, she takes her time and doesn't feel she has to hurry. She no longer needs you. And in her eyes you see nothing, no sign of love behind the tears cried for no one, a love that should have lasted years. You want her, you need her, and yet you don't believe her when she says her love is dead. You think she needs you. And in her eyes you see nothing, no sign of love behind the tears cried for no one, a love that should have lasted years. You stay home, she goes out, she says that long ago she knew someone, but now he's gone, she doesn't need him. Your day breaks, your mind aches, there will be times when all the things she said will fill your head. You won't forget her, and in her eyes you see nothing, no sign of love behind the tears cried for no one, a love that should have lasted years.
Mick, why that one?
Yeah,
out of all the Beatles songs.
That's a beautiful question, that.
Yeah. I was listening to this album the other day, because it's been redone, hasn't it? And she said, it's a... I was listening to that and going, I've heard this song my whole life, but now I'm going to really listen to it. It's incredibly difficult to play because it keeps going into 3-4, and even though it's simple chords, so to get it exactly the way they do it. But it's just unbelievable. It's a magnificent piece of writing. Yeah. And then I obviously stretched out into the rest of the album, so I've been listening to this one as well.
Yeah.
So I can see where you're coming from, but why that one?
It's, you know, I was only recently, not having the albums growing up, say Revolver or Rubber Soul, for example, like sitting in a pub one day and listening to, it's like, I'm Only Sleeping or something. And then I'm thinking, I said to my mate, who's this? And he's going, what are you on about? What album is this? He's going, it's the Beatles. And I'm going, what album's it on? He's going, are you for real?
Really?
Yeah. Because only had the greatest hits growing up. And then
The Red and the Blue.
Yes, exactly. So The Red and the Blue.
Yeah.
And so some of the classics aren't on there.
No.
So then, there's, you know, out of all the Beatles, I've just said, there's however many songs, 1,000 songs. But only recently, I was in the rehearsal room with Phil, our drummer, and we were playing it, and this came on. And another stopped me in my tracks. That's why I chose it, because it stopped me in my tracks again. I just thought, oh, Macca. Such a beautiful You've done it there. And because I think he's underrated.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? Wow. Yeah, I'll buy that.
Do you know, I think he's absolutely... That song...
it's a breakup song, isn't it? It's
a I think it is.
It is. It's a breakup song.
Jane Asher, was it, maybe?
Yeah. And you've got to listen to it or go online and look at the lyrics and realise, my God, it's not what your instinct tells you.
I don't want to hear She Loves You ever again in my whole life because I hear it every time I walk down a bloody street, but... If you just look slightly under the surface, there's these things, these gems, which are, as you say, he's underrated, which is just what a mad thing to say. Yeah. But it's true.
No, I mean, I think he doesn't get the... I mean, obviously, he's macher.
Yeah.
He's macher. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? But, you know, he's a...
Have you ever met him?
Do you know who once? Jack were out of party... An enemy party, and
Mick's killing himself laughing here. By the way, listeners,
it was brilliant. It was Vintage Macca. Well, they were on the way in. It was like an award ceremony, so it was chocker. So it's let's say like the 90s or something like that.
Yeah.
And everyone was, we always blamed these champers they were given on the way in spiked. So everyone's drinking the champers on the way in. So we're all marching in like that. Macca's holding court. And we're all marching in like that. And we dared, that he dared of us, and vice versa like that. So, but wasn't being. So, I just give it that. And he went like that, and he went. And then I could see the thumbs sort of slowly going down. I didn't even the fuck see. So, no.
Nearly.
Nearly.
Yeah.
Half Macca of a meeting.
No, but got the non-thumb.
I got half a thumb.
that's more than most of us have got anyway, isn't it?
I'd love to meet him.
Yeah.
That'd be incredible.
Same. I dream about it sometimes.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Because he's kind of the... when you write a song, you always try to make sure that you've got a lovely melody in there, which has not been heard before in any other song. And because, you know, the song might just... You might have a great lyric, but if it's not got a decent tune, it might just wither on the vine and not.
Yeah.
And I think he's the godfather of all that, you know, of us. And it's... And for being in this area, it's kind of our... It's our birthright to try and...
Yeah.
You know, he is the don of melody, isn't he?
He's loads of things. He's the don, isn't he?
Yeah.
His bass playing.
Oh, Jesus, yeah.
I think he's up there with one of my favourite bass players because he's playing melodies.
Yeah.
Do you remember when we had that guy, that American journalist on called James Campion, and he's written a whole book about Hey Jude.
Yeah.
And wow. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like a bit kind of self-indulgent that it's not as it is.
It's really interesting.
My God, he goes through it and he talks about the little bit of the background about the contributions all four made, although it was mainly Macca's song, and it was just... An eye opener, wasn't it? You know.
Well, he's saying it. He's telling the story. Yeah. I get you. He's asking them. You know, how does he know? He's been asking them.
Well, he's interpreting and going back to sources, isn't he?
He's gone back to the sources.
So he's saying, Paul did this bit. John suggested this. George did this.
That's interesting.
And it's a whole book, and it's not difficult to read or anything. You don't have to be a musician.
Yeah.
To appreciate it, and it's a whole book on that. And if you say that to someone's written a whole book, 300 pages on Hey Jude, they think, oh my God.
Yeah, but you'd read a book about the Mona Lisa, wouldn't you?
Yeah, you would.
It's the same thing, isn't it?
It was a big song, wasn't it? Hey Jude.
And he talks about the rehearsals and appearing on David Frost. I can remember as a kid babysitting, age 10, and they came on to David Frost, and I couldn't believe it because I knew that they'd broken up, that they're not playing
he
live
was
anymore.
Sarcastic with them, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was saying, and here's the greatest pocket orchestra in the world, and they're kind of looking at him and thinking, who the fuck are you? And then they played it. I remember sitting there with my sister and thinking, this is the Beatles live, and they're not doing live anymore. Yeah. And this book captures all that. Okay, I'll send you that.
Yeah, it's right.
It's boss.
Well, you picking it out there, that song. I think when he passes away and when Ringo passes away, we'll have this thing whereby people do deep dives on all of their music and their solo albums, and songs like this just getting pulled out and elevated to status. You know, and like his, there's a song called I'm Carrying. I think it's on the London Town album. Just fantastic bit of songwriting.
Yeah.
Just a lovely song. And I think people go, oh, Paul McCartney did that as well. You know, he's done so much, it'll just, it'll all come out slowly but surely because it's such a body of work.
Yeah.
And I mean, for yourself, you know, you got like a new record now. Does it, is part of your thought process that now you're older, we're older, that you're thinking about your body of work that you're going to leave? And I'm not trying to be morose. I'm trying to be like almost celebratory.
No.
You just write, you don't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because this is, you know, when you're gone, when we're gone, when you're gone, there will be a body of work which will be passed down.
Yeah,
through the ages. And that's an incredibly lovely thought, isn't
it? No, definitely. You know, I looked a couple of months ago, I think I had to, someone wrote them, all the songs down. It just shows like that, jeez. Really?
Put him away.
I think I was picking a set list.
Oh, yeah.
But I think that in a way makes the you know, the new stuff that we're doing thrive. You know, you've got a mindset, haven't you? Yeah. I'm always thinking ahead. I know what you mean. My daughter, you know, it is some kind of, you know, legacy you can pass on, you know, to your kids.
I think that about for our Rosie, you know, these songs will all be hers one day.
Yeah.
I go, this is, you know, this is it. And it's a really lovely thought, honestly.
Yeah.
I know what you're saying.
So Loophole's out in May, isn't it?
Yes.
And you're doing a tour.
Yeah.
Soon as well, aren't you?
Yeah.
Playing in loads of places.
Yeah, doing an acoustic tour, starts at the end of March to promote the album. Rough Trade Record Shops, you know, Rough Trade, Jacaranda, Glasgow. And then the tour with the band is in May, I think.
Yeah. And you're playing the Philharmonic?
Playing the Philharmonic at the end
of the
year.
Have you ever stood on the Philharmonic stage?
No, only been in. It's twice.
Unbelievable.
It is, right.
Yeah. I think I've played on it 15, 20 times for different things. Last time was supporting Elvis Costello.
Wow.
And for your music and the way that you play, it's going to be perfect.
Yeah, brilliant.
Because it's designed for the orchestra.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you just stand off the mic, back off the mic a little bit, you'll be able to feel your voice getting thrown around.
Oh, man.
And it's like when you first do it, it's a bit disconcerting because it's not like a rock and roll show.
Okay.
There's a lot of space.
Yeah.
And if you're not used to that, you know, we're used to playing some venues and it's all noise and rattling home and all that. But when you're playing at the Phil, all of a sudden there's loads of space for the musicians to go into.
Yeah.
You've got to.
Wow.
Honestly, God. And it's some of those songs, it will just... It'll be it's wide, you know.
Yeah,
Getting there early and get a feel for it. Honestly,
I remember when they renovated it about 20 years ago.
Yeah,
and the guy who was explaining it to us all said that all the chairs are acoustically designed.
Yeah, they are.
Down to the nearest detail. You know,
it's incredible.
Incredible amount of money and expertise and skills.
You definitely have that feeling though when you're in the field that you. Fucking hell, I've come from a council estate, nails me a pause, and I'm in the big posh fucking place here. You have to get over that bit first, you know. But you'll be honest. You know, it will be. It'll be.
In a way, it'll be
the crowning night for you, won't it?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Such a lovely idea to go and do it there.
Therefore, get a good orchestra, well, not orchestra, like a section behind us, some brass. Yeah.
Oh, you're going to say?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Therefore?
You don't do it there.
You've got to. I mean, I haven't really thought about it yet, but, we had about 17, 18 on stage with the choir a year or two ago.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, we will get some of the girls up if they're up for it.
Oh, that'd be fantastic.
Yeah.
Get
definitely.
Your job up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Definitely.
The final track that you've chosen, Mick, is by Duke Ellington.
Floret.
Okay.
African yeah. Floret.
Floret African.
Yeah. Basically, Martin, who plays trumpet with us, is, I was telling Mick earlier, he's jazz. I'm always, everyone in the van going, he's put some stuff on, inquisitive, I'm always asking, you know, what it is. And now and again, he sends me some stuff. But sticking with the team, stopping me in my tracks, he sent me at about 3 a.m. one evening, must have been leaded. Yeah. And so I didn't play it till the next morning. And since shower, put it on, boom. And it's one of them where you have to stop, get out, listen.
That is.
What's underneath the bass.
Something going on there.
Yeah, yeah. So.
The angle that they're coming at it.
Yeah, exactly. and the rhythm he's playing, like. Yeah. Mm, dum, boom, dum, 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 and the melodies and the rhythm, and I just thought, and the piano, and at Mr. Duke, and I thought, yeah, I'm having it. Yeah.
With Charles Mingus on bass.
But that's.
And Max Roach on drums. Yeah, it does. When you know that, you're thinking, whoa, that you take a step back.
There you go.
Again,
that's what got me out of the shower then.
I just always feel that there's so much more to learn, isn't there?
Yeah.
You know, that's what I love about that. God, I'm just starting.
Yeah, I think you know, I'm learning every day. The lads in the band, you know, a lot different strains of music than me.
Yeah. What a joy.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yes.
What's it like working with people who are, you know, maybe, I don't know, a lot younger than you, given that you were working with people of a similar age, I guess, when you started with the Paleys and with Shaq and that. What's it like that? Is it quite liberating or what?
It's us, because, you know, they're lovely lads for starters. You know, our big sings with us, that's my sister. But the lads in the band, you know, Martin's a bit younger than me, but the rest of the lads are half my age. And it's beautiful. It's important that we're all on the same page. Their mums and dads, as Yorkie did to me, tried to brainwash me. Their mums and dads have brainwashed them with Shaq and the Paleys.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So I'm in rehearsals one day and I'm playing a new song, saying, you know, let's get around this, and, you know, and at the end of the song, I'm thinking, wow, you know, that's fantastic. You just kind of know where to go.
Do they pester you to play Shaq or Pale Fountain songs that you don't play? Do they go, oh, can we play this one?
No, maybe once or twice someone's gone, did you ever do that? And I've gone, right. And I'm a sucker. I go like that, hold on, let's. So I started thinking the chords.
Yeah.
So I'll do that. Or if someone in the audience shouts, you know, can you do that? And I'll go, and I won't be able to remember, but I'll get home.
Yeah.
Learn the chords and then possibly do it the next one.
Okay.
But no, you know, as I said, when I'd said, they know where I'm going with some of the songs, because they grew up with Shaq and the Paleys since they were 10, 11, 12, 13,
wow.
You know.
Wow. Yeah. You can't really, can't get any better than that.
I touched lucky there, big
time.
You've
got the youthful vitality.
Yeah. Do you know?
And the deep experience of your mode of songwriting. So.
And they all look like male models, a lot of them. You know what I mean?
So, I wouldn't have that myself.
I'm telling you.
Knock that one on the head.
Yeah. I can get away with my age, can I? I'll just go like that. Yeah, but
well, I mean, it's having seen you play in Liverpool, it's, you know, your relationship, especially with the Liverpool audience, is remarkable, isn't it? The people who watch you, it's a notable thing how much they fucking love you, man.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah. There's one of the girls, Jenny, in the choir. You know, when she was singing with us, and she just said, "Yeah, there's a lot of love out there."
Yeah,
and I was saying, "I know, it's reciprocated."
Yeah,
you know, and there is, and it more so as I'm getting older, or as the band are playing more, they, you know, that's why I say you walk on stage and I'm automatically clapping back at them.
Yeah,
they're made up to see me. I'm made up to see them.
Yeah,
it's like mutual.
It sustains you, doesn't it?
It does.
Through when you're not having such bad days or something's not quite working out, that sustains
It's unbelievable.
You. Yeah.
You know, that goes right through your body.
Yeah. And that you know that...
It's genuine.
Yeah.
They're there to see you with total, utter belief in. And sometimes you think to yourself, wow, good on you. You know,
yeah.
I mean, some girl said at the audience the other week, I said, it's great to be here. And she said, we're astonished. You know what I mean? I was like, well, you know, it really is great to be here, you know?
Fantastic. Well, we're looking forward to the album Loophole coming out in May and the book in August. Ciao Ciao Bambino, is it called?
It is.
Is that right? Yeah, yeah. Well, we look forward to that. And we were very good. We only mentioned it once, didn't we? And we haven't talked about it, as agreed.
Good on you, lads. Respect.
No, not at all. Lovely to see you. Thanks for coming.
Thank
you. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, nice one.
Great
one. Thank you.
Thanks, Mick. Thanks for coming in.